Yeah.
And what is it?
Oh, it's a stupid bill. And, you know.
The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Let the record reflect that we do have quorum. And we are bringing back to the table Senate File 93, Senator Latz.
Where is
he? He's here. We're ready for you. Today is the Latz Rest Show.
The Latz Rest Show.
You are.
Me too.
You are.
Latz Rest Show.
You know, for the fearful who think that they will never find their way out of the Judiciary Committee, we would like the two of you to go forth and testify.
Madam Chair.
That is true.
We all have had bills like that.
And Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I think I must still have bills here because I thought that was the only reason I was here.
Well, and Madam Chair, you're not making them raise their hands, the ones who want to escape.
It's okay. We haven't.
People can tail them as they go.
We haven't started yet. Senator Latz.
Hold my commitment on that front until I see how my bills go.
Well, it could go both ways, Senator Latz.
If I have to go forth and say you can get out.
Senator Latz, Senate File 93.
Yep, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
When I was sitting in that chair, I always told every author, I said, we want to make your visit to the Judiciary Committee memorable. And it always was.
Yes, I've been there a couple of times too, Mr. Yes. Chair.
And Madam Chair, memorable is one standard, but survivable is the one that I prefer.
We have fun. We have fun. We have fun. So Senator Latz has gone off and has done some great work, and I believe we have a number of amendments. Senator Latz, let's. Which one would you like to start with? We've got an A2, A3, A4, A5 members. All the amendments should be in your packets.
Yes, sir.
A2, the findings?
Yes.
Yes.
This is for Senate File 93.
All right. Senator Betzel moves the A2 amendment.
Oh, do I have to? Well, Madam Chair, and I missed the meeting the other day, but I did talk to Senator Latz about this, and although many times findings are fluff and really have absolutely no purpose in the statute books, I do understand that there was considerable discussion the other day when I was actually presenting a bill in another committee that this area could be challenged even on constitutional grounds, and so it's my understanding that's the reason why, you know, we would like to at least establish what, you know, the concerns were in passing the bill. So just as we last year in the 35W bridge bill, we anticipated some legal issues there, and we had some findings in there. It may be appropriate to have it. So, yes, this on a rare occasion, I will move the A2 amendment.
Senator Betzel moves the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion on the A2 amendment?
Madam Chair.
The grammarians.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I just consulted with Senator Higgins, and she had read through this yesterday, but I wondered on line 6 if you want to put ensuring instead of insuring.
Oh, yeah.
We would like that to the other kind.
Yes.
Yes. Senator Betzel will accept that as a friendly amendment. All right. Any further discussions on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Latz.
I want to thank in particular Senator Higgins for a suggestion at the last committee hearing. The language that was adopted quite closely tracks the language in the Staley decision, the Supreme Court of Nebraska, which did find a rational basis for distinguishing between state and local governments. I also want to give credit and appreciation to Tom Grundhofer, League of Minnesota Cities Council, and on behalf of the local governments that testified at the last hearing. Mr. Grundhofer presented essentially the language that you have in front of you that you adopted in the amendment, so it was with the assistance of them that we did this. You also have, I think, as part of the basis for drawing this distinction between state and local government treatment in the tort law, and a fact sheet that Mr. Grundhofer has provided to staff regarding the question and answer to a question that came up at the last hearing, which was what additional insurance costs might be incurred by local governments if the local cap were to be declared unconstitutional or were to be deleted by statutory action. And because local governments have a pool, anyway, if not traditional insurance, and the state government is self-insured, there would be quite a significant difference in the cost to local governments, and I would ask that that fact sheet be made a part of the official record.
The fact sheet is, members should be in your packet, and that is a part of the record of the committee. The individuals who were here to testify, once we've dealt with the amendments, I understand that these amendments are an attempt to put the bill into shape. We will give people an opportunity to comment on the final package. The A3 amendment, Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, the A3 amendment has to do with the the amendment that was offered or read verbally by Ms. Pontius at the beginning of the last hearing relating to the budgeting for this, making the amounts available subject to available appropriations in any particular given year. And I asked that that language be stricken, and we were in the middle of discussing it. I don't think we ever reached a conclusion on that. I would think it'd be better since, as a matter of practice, everything is subject to available appropriations, although I also think the state, once ordered to pay, would have to make the appropriations available to delete this language. And there is an amendment, A5, that will be coming also that deals with sort of the finance end of this or the budgetary aspects of it.
So let's finalize the A3 amendment. Members, do you have questions for Senator Latz on the A3 amendment? Senator Scheid moves the A3 amendment. Any further discussions on the A3 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Do you want to, Senator Latz, do you want to take the A5 amendment since it deals with the same area?
Madam Chair, there's been some conversation about the use of the highway trust fund for responding to tort claims that arise out of MnDOT-related projects or highway-related events or accidents, crashes, liabilities. What I would propose in this matter is to rather than saying everything's got to come out of the highway trust fund, is to enable the transportation budget to go forward as it would ordinarily go forward. They have a line in their budget for dealing with tort claims. But in the event that there was a large event that would use up their regular appropriations for that, that any excess over that would come out of the general fund so that a large event such as would involve would cause the need to go beyond the usual tort liability would be spread out over the general fund, and that's what this amendment would do.
Any questions to Senator Latz on the A5 amendment? Members, just so that you know, this bill is going to go to finance, and I think it's going to be looked at by the Transportation Finance Division. So just in case, you know, you're wondering why we're acting on this amendment, it will go in the Transportation Finance Division. We'll have a chance to look at this. Any further discussions on the A5 amendment? All those in favor, did somebody move yet? Senator Higgins moved the A5 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, I'll move the final bill as amended.
I believe we have one more amendment, and then we'll have you move the bill. The A4 amendment. Senator Latz?
Madam Chair, A4 amendment was actually suggested to me by Senator Ortman. I want to state my appreciation to her for this suggestion. There was, again, out of concern for what might be a constitutional issue relating to the local government tort cap, state as a matter of law that if a court were ultimately court were to conclude that the local government tort cap is unconstitutional, if there is no state aggregate tort cap, this would say that we don't want to have a scheme where there is no aggregate tort cap support. Rather, we go back to the statutory scheme in place right now, which is tort cap for locals and tort cap for the state. I have a savings clause.
Contingent repealer.
Contingent repealer.
Any questions for Senator Latz?
Well, just
Senator Betzel.
The language will be just modified internally because, of course, we adopted a new section once finding, so it'll be changed, obviously, when it's engrossed, I guess.
Yes, the record will reflect that in the minutes, that we will internally make it consistent.
Okay.
Senator Ortman, would you like to move the A4 amendment?
I'll move the amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman moves the A4 amendment. Any further discussions on the A4 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Higgins moves Senate File 93. Is there, now that the bill has been put into shape, and Senator Latz, thank you for working so hard, and members of the committee, those of you who have given input to the bill, thank you. Are there anybody here to testify either for or against this bill now that we're we've put it into the shape that we need it to be in? Seeing none, Senator Higgins renews her motion that Senate File 93, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Latz, you want to do Senate File 261?
Yes, thank you. I'm going to invite Kevin Dunleavy, the chair of the Legislative Commission of the Real Property Section of the Minnesota State Bar Association, to join me at the witness table. Mr. Dunleavy is a real property specialist and is very familiar with the intricacies of real property law. Again, this year I am carrying the legislative initiatives of the Real Property Section to accomplish a number of things. Article 1 is a little bit of cleanup on the transfer on death deeds that the legislature passed as a part of the Real Property Sections bill last year. Article 2 deals with common elements of planned communities, which are not covered under existing law, but it would put them on equal footing with, for example, condominiums. And then there's miscellaneous provisions in Article 3, and I'd ask the committee to allow Mr. Dunleavy to...
Mr. Dunleavy, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Kevin Dunleavy, and I co-chair the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association. Article 1, Section 1. The legislature passed transfer on death deeds last session. That was probably one of the first major changes in real estate law since the Middle Ages. And we made one technical mistake. It took us 7 years to draft this. But the counties want us to have the name of the taxpayer in the affidavit of survivorship. That's when the transfer of title occurs, and they want to know where to send a tax statement. So that's what Section 1 does, is it puts the place where to send a tax statement in the affidavit of survivorship. Section 2, the Department of Human Services wanted an amendment to say that if there is a probate division of the district court, any dispute regarding a medical assistance lien on transfer on death property would be heard in that division. And I think that there's only two counties, Hennepin and Ramsey, that I'm aware of that have probate divisions of district court, but there may be some other counties in the state. Section 3 is just going along with the getting the tax statement into the affidavit. Section 5 is also along with that. Section 6 and Section 7, those are dealing with Torrance property and where the tax statements go and making sure that the deeds are valid. This change is retroactive, but deeds that were signed under the old law are still acceptable for recording. Article 2 extends the benefits of common element certificates of title to planned communities under the Torrance Act. Right now, if you have a condominium, and in a condominium, you own the box inside the building. The condominium association owns the exterior of the building and all the dirt. Those are all common areas. And right now, if, for example, a mechanics lien contractor does work on the roof, they can file a mechanics lien just on that common element certificate of title. Or if the condominium association gets a mortgage, the mortgage just has to go on that common element certificate of title instead of all the units. And planned unit developments are primarily single-family detached, but densely, there's a high density use of the land. And this benefit under the Torrens Act would now be extended to planned unit communities as well. Okay, Article 3 allows designated transfers without the use of a certificate of real estate values. Designated transfer is I'm the sole owner of an LLC or a corporation. I own the real estate, and I'm transferring the real estate to a corporation that I own solely. There's no change in the beneficial ownership of that real estate, and under Department of Revenue rules and deed tax rules, there's no need for any more than the minimum deed tax. This change says now you don't have to file a certificate of real estate value either. Certificates of real estate value are used by the county to determine comparable sales for assessment of property taxes, and also the Department of Revenue tracks them to see that people are paying the income tax on the gain. The Department of Revenue doesn't consider, and the assessors don't consider these sales to be arm's length transactions, so they don't need a certificate of real estate value. Section 3 of Article 3. Two sessions ago, the legislature authorized municipalities to make township roads. Township roads are used in rural areas when a property doesn't have access to a public road. The township can allow a road of 2 rods or 32 feet, and the township determines the compensation for the landowner. This is good, generally speaking, good public policy, because it makes it so that landlocked property can be developed. The municipalities wanted that ability, and the legislature authorized that 2 years ago, but didn't give them a procedure. And so this is intended to give the municipalities the same procedure that the townships have for township roads. Section 4, affidavits of attorney in fact. The main purpose of an affidavit of attorney in fact is to show that the affiant, the attorney in fact, doesn't have any knowledge that the principal is deceased. And that's actually, a lot of times people think that powers of attorney survive past death, but they don't. And so it's a lot of times when the attorney in fact realizes that they don't have the power to act on behalf of the principal anymore when they sign the affidavit. Well, corporations don't die, so they don't need affidavits of attorney in fact to show that they're alive. And the Notary Act also says that if a person signs in a representative capacity, that's prima facie evidence of authority. So putting those two things together, the real property section thought it was unnecessary to have affidavits of attorney in fact for corporations. You know, I think I will. That's all I have.
Mr. Dunleavy, in that section, there is an interesting effective date. Can you talk a little bit about that?
The one about
lines 10.1 and 10.2. That's a retroactive effective date for the attorney in fact.
Well, the reason for that is because a lot of the foreclosures that are happening are done under powers of attorney by corporations, and it's impossible to get affidavits of attorney in fact. And so this is intended to clear the titles for those foreclosures so that the property can be marketable and get back in the stream of commerce.
I told you it was unusual. Any questions for Mr. Dunleavy? Senator Parasol and then Senator Lemmer. Senator Parasol?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dunleavy, you said it's sometimes impossible to get would this be because it's corporate property rather than residential? Or does it matter whether it's residential or corporate?
Well, excuse my language, but it's because it's a big, dumb corporation that's out of state, and it's impossible to get them. They just don't respond.
You made it much clearer, I think.
They don't respond. You can't. I mean, it's just impossible to convince people to sign these affidavits, and so you can't get them.
Thank you.
Senator Lemmer?
I'm really tempted to talk about the big, dumb private owner outside of the state, too, but I don't think I will. But would it do any damage to the bill if we remove the retroactivity portion of it? I'm always hesitant to support bills that have retroactivity. Is there a particular individual that would benefit, or are they in a bind that we're trying to help out by creating the retroactivity?
Not that I'm aware of. I think
Mr. Dunleavy?
Excuse me. I'm not Senator Lemmer and Senator Moe. I'm not aware that anybody is pushing this other than a bar association to clear titles.
Anybody here to testify either for or against this bill? Any further discussions from members?
I'll move the bill, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins moves that. Let's see. Let me see here to make sure we have it right.
This looks too warm.
Madam Chair, it should go to local government, state local government.
No. Yes. Senate File 261 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Government, Local Government Operations. Senator Rest? State and Local Government Operations and Oversight. Wanted to get the right name. I apologize. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Now, Senator Lance, go forth and spread the word. Is Senator Anderson here yet? Because if she's not, we're going to...
I think they were done when I left.
Senator Rest? 137, whichever one you want to take first.
Madam Chair, I would prefer to take Senate File 137 first.
Senate Rest.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I have an author's amendment that I believe Council has.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, could you get closer to the microphone? Closer to the microphone?
Sure.
Is it the A3 amendment, Senator Rest?
That's correct.
Members, you should have the amendment in your packets. Senator Rest, would you like to walk us through the A3 amendment?
Madam Chair, the A3 amendment strikes two lines in on page 5 of the bill that are unnecessary as it's currently drafted. And line 5 of the bill changes the effective date to August 1st, 2010 from July 1st in order to have the give the Department of Health a little bit more time. Senator Anderson is here. Would you like me to step aside?
If that's okay, because we're going to take this one. I apologize.
No problem.
Senator Anderson?
Oh, there she is.
Thank you. I'm here.
you, Madam Chair. You run a very efficient committee.
Yep.
Right. Go forth.
Thank you. Let me
quickly.
Just get organized here.
Senate File 297.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a, I hesitate to say this, it's always bad luck to say this is a very simple bill, but I'll try.
Wrong committee.
I introduced this bill about 2 years ago on behalf of my constituent, Matthew Tandy, who is here. And he brought to my attention the issue that he was a law student and a part-time sheriff's deputy and intended to practice law, and asked if I knew about this law that says that you can't do both under Minnesota law. You can't be a sheriff and work at a sheriff's office as a deputy or an elected sheriff and be a practicing attorney at the same time. And I think that's the law where we were unable to find when this law was actually passed. It was long before any of us were born. So it's been on the books for a very long time, and all the original legislative history is not available. But Mr. Tandy now is a practicing attorney, and he works full-time as a lawyer and
yes.
part-time as a Washington County deputy sheriff. And I couldn't think of any reason why we would want to forbid that by law, and so that's why I brought this bill forward. Now, we have some proposed amendments to the original bill, and this is the first hearing, so I guess I'd like to ask the committee to start by putting the delete all amendment on. I think that's what we're going to work off of.
It's members, it's the A1 amendment. It's in your packet. There are two.
Oh, there's two. I'm sorry.
I believe there's an A1 and A3. Let's take the A1 amendment as the author's amendment, which is a delete all amendment. Senator Olson moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author desires it to be in. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we, the effect of the delete all amendment would be to keep the language in place that says that a sheriff is not eligible to hold another elective office, and we didn't want to repeal that. We just wanted to repeal the part that prohibits an attorney from being a sheriff. Now, subsequent to introducing this and scheduling the hearing, we've had, my staff has been in contact with the Sheriff's Association. I've also talked with a representative from the Bar Association, and the issue that arises with the Sheriff's Association is that they would like to maintain this prohibition in law for the elected sheriff position. And I asked if there's any part-time elected sheriffs in Minnesota, and I was told no. They're all full-time. And so I don't know if you want to hear from the Sheriff's Association, but that was their position, that they would be, as far as I can speak to their position, they'd be fine with this bill as long as we only repeal the prohibition for deputy sheriffs and keep the prohibition in place for the elected sheriff. And I would leave that up to the committee to decide. And so there's another amendment that could achieve that limitation. But at a minimum, we'd like to ask you to repeal the prohibition on a deputy sheriff being able to practice law. The other conversation that I had with the Bar Association was about whether there could be cases of conflict, of course, that could arise if you're practicing law and you have another job, just like those of us who are attorneys and are legislators can run into conflicts, or other joint where you have two professions. And basically the Supreme Court likes to set those rules and has jurisdiction over those rules of professional responsibility and what are conflicts. And so I don't think we need to specify any restrictions in that regard in this law, but that's another issue that's come up for discussion. So I don't believe that that's a problem. I think that's covered by the Code of Professional Responsibility and any other conflict of interest laws that might pertain. Would you like to just hear from Mr. Tandy for a moment?
Okay.
Absolutely, Mr. Tandy. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Matthew Tandy, T-A-N-D-E. I guess a little bit of perspective, this law I think was originally passed back when my grandfather was a sheriff's deputy. Things were very different back then. I don't think there was civil service for sheriff's deputies. I think it was the sheriff called my grandpa up and said, hey, you want to work for me? And he said, sure. But I think based on the language of the bill as it stands now of the statute, is it was intended to prohibit sheriff's deputies from self-dealing, because back in those days, sheriff's deputies, I believe, got paid cash by attorneys or by parties to serve papers. And my guess, I don't have any legislative history to support that, but my guess is that this law was intended to prohibit self-dealing by attorneys paying themselves or their friends to serve papers. That said, I guess I have a couple of statements. First of all, I think it's prudent that an elected sheriff, there's one sheriff elected in each county, and then there are deputy sheriffs who are hired pursuant to civil service rules to act as sheriff's deputies. They're kind of separate. The sheriff is the head of the department, but the deputies work for him, but they don't work at his pleasure. It's civil service rules now. And so I don't think there's any conflict with sheriff's deputies working as attorneys. However, an elected sheriff, I agree that there should be some restraints on the elected sheriff. As far as the issue of conflict of interest, this law is overbroad and underbroad. It's overbroad because it prohibits my working as an attorney and a sheriff's deputy when no conflict of interest exists. And it's also underbroad because there's no similar prohibition against a police officer, a state trooper, or a conservation officer serving as an attorney and an officer also. So it's underbroad in that it doesn't prohibit any conflict of interest there. Third of all, I don't think this law was intended to prohibit conflicts of interest per se between someone being a sheriff's deputy and being an attorney. I think that the rules of professional conduct work very well for weeding out conflicts of interest and guiding attorneys, and I don't believe that there's any necessity for having a sheriff's deputy prohibited carte blanche from serving as an attorney when the rules of professional conduct do that very well on a case-by-case basis, which I think is more can be tailored to the individual situation.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Taney? Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, couldn't this bill be drafted much more narrowly for the purposes of your constituent by just simply saying that you can't do it in you can't serve as both an attorney, practice as an attorney and work as a deputy sheriff in the same jurisdiction, so that he could work as a deputy sheriff in Washington County if that's where you're employed and practice law anywhere else, but that would give the residents and the sheriff some understanding of what's happening in that jurisdiction. I do think that there is a potential conflict in that a deputy sheriff often is called on to testify on service of process, and in civil proceedings, police officers usually aren't for that aspect of it, for the civil aspect of it. And so I'm wondering if you couldn't fashion it more narrowly just to allow him to practice law, just not in the jurisdiction where he's serving as a deputy sheriff.
That's certainly a possibility I thought of, but I think I look more to subject matter rather than geography. So I'm a sheriff's deputy in Washington County. I do primarily disability law, guardianships and conservatorships, and probate. I see no overlap. We use private process servers there, so I don't really see any subject matter jurisdiction overlap there between my work as a sheriff's deputy and my potential work as an attorney.
Madam Chair, I guess
Senator Anderson.
Again, I think you know there could be a rare case where there could be some conflict that arises, and I think that existing laws and regulations would apply to that. But it would really restrict his ability to practice law if he could practice in 87 counties, but not in the county that his other job is in. And so I'm not sure that I think that might be a little restrictive and a little rigid, depending on the circumstances. And I'll just leave it at that.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, there's also the question, Senator Anderson, of the supervision of the employee as a deputy sheriff and the potential risk of liability for the county and the sheriff's office if there were a problem. And I think that I'm not sure how anyone would object if the deputy sheriff were not practicing law in that jurisdiction. But there could be problems if a lawyer were practicing law in that same jurisdiction. And so with that said, I won't be able to support your bill unless you make some kind of change to that so that the sheriff has the opportunity to completely supervise the sheriffs and the deputy sheriffs, and also have the flexibility to ask them to do whatever duty it might be, whether it be civil service of process or something else. That flexibility for the sheriff is also important. I think there are some good justifications for having this, but I also think we can probably make some clarifications here to allow your client to practice law as well.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, I don't see any conflict of interest there. These kinds of things have gone on and off for years. I've been doing that for the last 14 years as a prosecutor and deputy sheriff and other things. And I, you know, what's the conflict of interest?
And I think, Madam...
Senator Anderson?
Well, Madam Chair, it seems to me that the sheriff is in a position to make a decision when they hire a deputy about whether they think they're qualified and able to adequately perform the duties of the job. And one of those questions would be, you know, I would think this would be a valid question, but I don't know why we wouldn't leave that to the discretion of individual sheriffs to be able to make that decision.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, most sheriff's offices have off-duty employment policies, and this would definitely impact those off-duty employment policies. Some sheriffs don't allow their deputy sheriffs to serve as security outside of the normal course of duties for those same kinds of conflicts. In this case, you would have the instance of a deputy sheriff being a witness in cases in that jurisdiction and also appearing as a lawyer, and that could create some appearances of impropriety. That appearance is also important for lawyers who practice law. There could be some confusion about that role. The sheriff might not know about every case that comes up, and that supervision is a great responsibility for the sheriff. How will the sheriff know 5 years after you've hired someone what kind of practice of law that person has? And, you know, that's not the role of the sheriff to supervise his employees to allow them to practice law. And so I think with just one clarification here, you could solve all the problems here and also address your constituents' needs, Senator Anderson.
Mr. Franklin, are you here? Mr. Franklin's from the Sheriff's Association.
I have the amendment. I just want to get there. I haven't got a chance to get there yet.
Mr. Franklin, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Jim Franklin. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. And despite my youthful appearance, I've been around for 41 years and not quite when this law was written, so I don't have the exact history. I'll try to be very brief, concise, and then be excused. But let me just say that we sheriffs are very concerned that conflicts of interest could come up. We go to great lengths to try to avoid any type of conflicts of interest. When this law was crafted, I believe the history dealt with the fact, as Mr. Candy has already reported, that mischief could occur. A sheriff could draft papers, serve papers, execute papers, do everything all in one swoop. That's different from a law enforcement officer being a police officer or a state trooper because they don't have the authority or they don't deal with civil process like a sheriff does. Secondly, I would just reiterate that almost every sheriff's office has an off-duty policy currently in place, which means that if you're going to work off-duty because of the reasons of liability that Senator Ortman has already appointed to, if a sheriff's deputy is doing something off-duty, the city, the county can be held liable for something in an off-duty employment status. That is why the sheriff's offices require the employees to come in, usually on an annual basis, and tell the sheriff what it is that you're doing in your off-duty status, reaffirm that what you're doing is approved, and go right ahead and continue to do what you're doing. Mr. Tandy's idea with regards to litigation or other kinds of things that could be restricted under his licensure as an attorney is a very workable kind of solution. And I have some words here, if possible, that I could recommend that I believe solves the problem, yet maintains the sheriff's ability to control this and limits the county's liability, yet will accomplish what Mr. Tandy is attempting to try to do. And that's simply stated is if we would insert the words in Chapter 387.13, no sheriff, deputy sheriff, without the approval of their appointing authority. That means when you come in for your off-duty employment, the sheriff puts restrictions on you. And as Mr. Tandy has already alluded to, you would put restrictions on litigation within the department or within the county or something like that. Or you could say, you know, don't serve papers or don't do this or don't do that, whatever it would be, either by topic or by geography, whichever. That would be the opportunity for the sheriff and the applicant for the employment to come to some sort of an agreement, what makes sense, because it's very difficult when we craft a law to think of every possible thing. Thereby, leaving this language, it allows the applicant and the sheriff to negotiate and come to something that makes sense, that covers the liability issues, and that yet gives the employee the opportunity to have the employment that they are seeking here. So we think with this language, it would restrict it enough that it would work and that all parties would be able to continue on. Liability would protect it, and yet the deputy would be able to continue his study for becoming an attorney and practicing law at some point in time.
Mr. Tandy, are you still a student?
I am not.
So you have your law license?
I do.
And you're currently practicing law?
Yes, I am.
And are you still currently a deputy sheriff?
I am.
So how are you able to do that now, even though we haven't changed the law?
I do it. That's what I do, and it's you know, that's fine. I knew that coming in here, but that's what I do. I don't believe there's a conflict of interest. My primary objective is to make sure that there are no conflicts of interest. I don't believe that I have any conflicts of interest in my practice. So the state law, notwithstanding that.
Mr. Tandy, did you have to get the your legal practice approved through?
Right. So.
Did you have a conversation with your supervisor about the off-hour work?
Yes, I did. Yes, I had a conversation with my supervisor about this statute specifically and about my work. My supervisor at both the Sheriff's Department and at my practice of law both agreed they didn't believe there was a conflict of interest there.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
I do want to say, you know, I've heard of a number of people who are in a position like Mr. Tandy's. I don't think he's the only one in Minnesota, and so I want to give him credit for coming forward and asking us to change the law because he believes he wants to comply with the law.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I wonder if perhaps Mr. Franklin could tell me, is there other authority for, or is there existing authority for sheriffs to say what kind of outside or what people can do in their off-duty hours, or is that just something that comes with the job?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Franklin.
Madam Chair, yes, there is existing case law, and there's been a number of things that deal with that particular topic. And I would suggest that in this case, if I was informed that he was a student, but didn't know that he was actually a practicing attorney. But in this particular case, it would be that with the sheriff's approval that you're doing it, with my amendment, you've already accomplished what he's asking to do. And so I think by putting my amendment in, we've already solved the problem because he's already gone to his sheriff and said, can I do this, of which he said, yes. And so to that degree, with the inclusion of that amendment, it solves the problem, and it does not make him a lawbreaker by which we then have to effect an arrest, which would be very awkward.
And then, Madam Chair, if I might,
Senator Scheid,
if I might just follow up on that, I'm assuming that if Mr. Tandy were a criminal defense lawyer, his boss at the Sheriff's Department might find that a conflict, and certainly his employer in the law firm would also. And so as long as sheriffs have that ability to approve, I don't know how Senator Anderson feels about that language, but it's without the approval of the sheriff. No one may do, you know, can you?
Mr. Tandy?
I guess, first of all, this is a petty misdemeanor, same as a speeding offense. I'll admit to you that I did exceed the speed limit on my way here today. So we'll put that in perspective. Second of all.
Senator Foley will get you.
That's fine. And then second of all, I have no objection to the policy. In my current sheriff's department, the policy is that all work non-related to the sheriff's department must be approved by the sheriff.
Senator Anderson.
Remember, Mr. Tandy brought this bill to me while he was a law student. Mm-hmm. Yes. He was trying to get the law changed before he became a practicing lawyer, so we shouldn't hold him to the fact that it took 2 years to get this bill passed. I hope. Well, we're just starting. I don't object to this language. I think it's superfluous because I think we've established that this authority already exists and is broadly used. But if it would make everyone comfortable, I guess that's your decision. I don't think it does any harm either. So I would just leave that up to the committee. I think it would achieve the purpose Senator Ortman is perhaps getting at, but I think the sheriffs already do have that authority and tend to exercise it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
I'd move the amendment, the language suggested, and maybe Ms. Pontius or Mr.
Senator Betzel.
I don't know who's working.
Well, Madam Chair, I think I'd like to hear from Ms. Pontius to see if the language works.
Right. Ms. Pontius has been scribbling away.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson.
Ms. Pontius has to do a lot more scribbling. Let me just suggest the A2 amendment. I don't know if you have that in front of you, but it might be why, if the committee wants to just apply this to deputy sheriffs, it might be better to work off the A2 amendment. And I wanted to have that discussion first. But that's obviously the request of the Sheriff's Association. They would be more comfortable with that, and we're fine with that. So the A2 amendment change basically just strikes deputy sheriff or coroner from the existing law.
Ms. Pontius, do you want to direct us on what is the cleanest way to achieve this amendment?
Madam Chair and members, I think, first of all, you want on line 5 of the A2. I guess the question, where do you want coroners in this? They're kind of a separate discussion, but
I don't have a position on coroners, okay. Madam Chair.
So if you wanted to leave coroners stricken, so you'd reinstate on line 5, it would read no sheriff or deputy sheriff. And then just to make it a little easier, I would then on line 9 after the period insert this prohibition does not apply to a deputy sheriff who has the approval of, and I don't know if you want to say sheriff or appointing authority, would that always be the sheriff?
Probably would be.
Yes. Approval of their sheriff would be their elected sheriff.
Yes. You could say this prohibition does not apply to a deputy sheriff who is acting with the approval of the appointing sheriff.
Right.
Okay, member, we're looking at the A2 amendment that's in front of you. I'm going to have Ms. Pontius read that amendment one more time.
Madam Chair and members, on the A2 on line 5, you'd read after the stricken comma, then insert an or, and then reinstate the deputy sheriff. So it'd read no sheriff or deputy sheriff, or coroner would remain stricken. And then on line 9, after the period insert, this prohibition does not apply to a deputy sheriff who is acting with the approval of the appointing sheriff.
And the A2 amendment is the delete all amendment. With that, is that drawn up to now the amended bill, Ms. Pontius, or could we just...
Madam Chair, I think probably the easiest thing would be to do this as a new delete everything amendment, which would replace the A1 that you already
So the adopted. A2 will be a new delete everything amendment to the bill as amended.
I'd move that, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid moves the A2 amendment. Anybody here to testify want to comment on the A2 amendment? Senator Foley.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry.
I guess what I'd like to say, first of all, is that I don't think what you're doing is necessary. And to say that a deputy sheriff who happened to be a lawyer couldn't act in any other capacity just doesn't stand up. If you look at police officers that have gone to different jurisdictions, we've got all these alcohol and seatbelt violations that are being done, and the deputies, for the most part, are covered by APELRA or a similar union contract, and I just don't see why we need anything. The amendment that the sheriff have brought forward, I guess it's probably harmless, but it's just cluttering up the statute book, in my mind.
Senator Olson and then Senator Parasol. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry I had to leave for a few minutes and have a call back to my county board back in my district. But Senator Limmer tells me that you haven't talked about the conflict of interest. I heard Senator Anderson say, you know, that the legislative history for why we had this prohibition to begin with is kind of murky and from a long time ago. But when I think about in rural communities, especially where there are fewer law firms and fewer people practicing, and having worked a little bit of time in a prosecutor's office, I just wonder if that was that potentially the reason why we had this prohibition to begin with, because you don't want someone arresting someone who might also be representing that person potentially, or you don't want someone maybe referring business to themselves. I mean, I don't know. I'm just wondering if that I would feel a lot better if I knew why we had this to begin with.
And I believe Mr. Tandy and Mr. Franklin both spoke to that. So, okay. Mr. Tandy, could you please quickly recap self-dealing? Was it?
Self-dealing. I think with the service of process. I think in smaller counties that would have been an issue back in the day when the sheriff was doing a lot more work in the criminal process than just arresting someone. Also, you know, sheriff's departments do have very strict policies on conflict of interest, and certainly my department, if I were to be handing out my attorney's business cards at the sheriff's department, if I were to be doing any kind of self-promotion as an attorney, I would be fired, and I know that's happened in the past. So I think that's something that's pretty well covered in most departments' policies.
Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, I believe that the language brought by Mr. Franklin does a better job, and it's less restrictive with no penalty. Why would you penalize someone for doing something they could probably do well, even if it was dual? But, I mean, I think that his language is superior to this.
Very good.
So
members,
I don't like the amendment very well yet.
On the SHIDE A2 amendment, I believe on line 10, we also need to insert or deputy sheriff. We insert the language to be consistent. On the A2 amendment, is there a further discussion? Seeing none, Senator SHIDE removes her motion to adopt the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Senator SHIDE, is there anybody else here who would like to testify now on the amended bill? Senator SHIDE?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to say to Senator Parasol that we did incorporate the language that Mr. Franklin suggested. Yes. That was part of that. So
thank you.
And then with that, Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 297 as amended be recommended to pass.
And you refer to the floor.
And refer to go right to the floor.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in Senator Betzel.
Do we need any special immunity for Mr. Tandy since he admitted breaking the law? This is the law today. And should he be arrested like this?
Senator Betzel, you're not suggesting an amendment to now the amended bill, are you?
No. But I'm sure Senator Anderson will tell everybody, we'll go forth and spread the word about her easy bill.
Yes. All those in favor of the SHIDE motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tandy. Thank you, Mr. Franklin. That was a very good suggestion. Now, Senator Rest.
Okay.
There's Senator
and an editor.
Members, we have back in front of us Senate File 137. Senator Ress walked us through the A3 amendment, which is an author's amendment. Senator Olson moves the A3 amendment to put the bill into the shape that the author would like it to be in. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Now, Senate File 137, Senator Ress.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Senate File 137 is a bill that was heard last year and passed by the legislature, not exactly in the form. There's one change that I'll point out to you, that this committee passed it to the floor of the Senate, but the bill, as it went to Governor Pawlenty, who at that time vetoed it, is essentially the same as the bill that we have in front of us, except for the amendment that we just put on. And what the bill does is to permit adopted persons age 19 and over to have access to a non-certified copy of their original birth certificate if there's no affidavit of disclosure on file. And just to go briefly through the bill to point out the major provisions, in Section 1, there's just a cross-reference to the new law that is adopted, and and there is a repealer, by the way, too, so that people know what this proposes to replace. In Section 2, there is an amendment to 144.218 sub 1 that provides that an original birth record is private data on individuals, and current law classifies it as confidential, which would mean that it would not be available to the person on whom it is being kept, as I understand the difference in the definition. So that it adds that an adopted person who is at least 19 years of age shall be able to access the information contained on the original birth certificate, again, unless an affidavit of nondisclosure is on file. Section 3 adds another cross-reference to the proposed coding in the bill. Section 4 also does the same, adds the new coding for the bill. And Section 5 is actually the heart of the policy proposal that is before us. In Subdivision 1, the Department of Health would be required to prepare affidavit of disclosure and nondisclosure forms and make those forms readily accessible to birth parents on the department website. The adoptees for whom this bill is particularly applicable are those that were adopted prior to 1977. In the law change that was done in 1981, adoptions after 1977 have the provisions already in law for affidavits of disclosure or nondisclosure. And in a search that was done a couple of years ago, we found that since 1981, there were some 11,000 plus affidavits of disclosure, some 1,000 plus affidavits of nondisclosure, and the relationship was like 90% disclosure, 10% nondisclosure. Those affidavits of nondisclosure will still stand. No one needs to go and write and sign a new affidavit. So the affidavits of disclosure. In another part of the bill, we reaffirm that a birth parent can change her mind about. There's no statute of limitations on whether you want to change your mind about changing from either one status or from either status to the other. Subdivision 2 provides that the state registrar will give a non-certified copy of the original birth certificate upon request to an adopted person if there is no affidavit of nondisclosure on file. The Subdivision 3 is the affirmation of the permission for a birth parent to rescind an affidavit of disclosure or non-disclosure at any time. Subdivision 4 indicates that if an affidavit of non-disclosure is on file, that an adopted person 19 years of age or older can petition the court for access to the birth record. And it directs the court to, in considering that petition, to determine whether disclosure of the information would be of greater benefit than non-disclosure, and if it so finds, then it can grant the petition. Subdivision 5 instructs the department, consulting with adoption agencies and adoption advocates, to provide information and educational materials to adopted persons and birth parents about the changes in access to birth records, and it also includes a definition of adoption advocate. And in paragraph B in sub 5, there is a provision that the department give notice on its website about the change in law as part of the information and education and outreach that will be done under the provisions of this law if it would pass, which it delays the effective date until, by the amendment, until August 1st, 2010, to allow that kind of education and outreach to go on. In Section 6, it allows or authorizes the department to charge an $18 fee for non-certified copies. For those of us who are born in Minnesota who are not adopted, the charge for the current charge for a birth certificate is $14, but because they will have this extra thing there of the affidavit of disclosure or non-disclosure, we wanted to make sure that the entire fee would cover the costs that were associated with this special kind of request. Also in Section 8, there is when a child is adopted following the termination of a parental right, then that is court-ordered, there is still the provision that that parent also has the right to file an affidavit of non-disclosure, even though they don't have rights to the child prior to the possible adoption. So whether that child is ever adopted or not, the person whose rights have been terminated would have the right of any other birth parent to file an affidavit of non-disclosure. And then Section 9 are the repealers. In the in your handouts or in your packets, there is a summary of the bill, and also from MCAR, the Minnesota Coalition for Adoption Reform, and it also, I think, gives a very good flow chart for what will happen or what the current law is and the effects of this bill with regard to streamlining the process. We started it last year, streamlining the process last year for requests going back and forth between Department of Human Services and the Department of Health. So we eliminated one step last year, and then under this bill, the process would be the one that's on the under page. I would point out that in the bill last year that you passed, the one difference in the bill that you're seeing before you today regarded the if a birth parent had died. And in the bill that we had last year, we said that if a birth parent were deceased, notwithstanding any affidavits on file, an original birth certificate could be granted to an adult adoptee upon their request. In this bill, we are silent on that, and so we are just keeping current law. And I would point out that what on this, the more complicated section, if you look at where in the green section, the second box there, that if the birth parent is found to be deceased, there can be three conditions. There's no affidavit on file, there's an affidavit on disclosure on file, or there's an affidavit of non-disclosure. Current law says that if there is an affidavit of non-disclosure, that remains in effect, and an original birth certificate is not available to an adult adoptee unless, of course, they petition the court. Under current law, if a birth parent has died and there is no affidavit on file, or rather, there is an affidavit of disclosure, then the Department of Health may release the birth record. So we are not getting rid of that third box saying that if the non-disclosure affidavit of non-disclosure has been filed, it is. We're not proposing any change in that, and the birth parent's name would not appear on the birth certificate that an adult adoptee received. So there'd be no difference in current law. This is an issue, obviously, that has been around for some time. We've worked with any number of groups to arrive at a balance between concern and consideration and compassion for the opportunities for birth parents, for adopted persons, and for adopting families to respect the rights of each person or each entity in this adoption triangle. We're really pleased last year that and that continues to be the case, that the two out of the three major adoption agencies in the state of Minnesota helped us draft some of the compromise language and then became neutral on a bill that in past years they had opposed. We have talked with many people who were skeptical about the bill last year and have talked to them about how the attitudes have changed and adoption laws are changing around the country, and have been very gratified that with additional information and discussion that they support the bill.
Thank you, Senator Rest. I just want to note that Representative Tingelstad's in a room. And, you know, in the past, you couldn't be at the table, but I would invite you to come and sit with Senator Rest today if you would like. I know that the two of you have tagged team on this for a long time, and I think it means a lot to you personally, and I'd like to have you come. Please. Any questions for Senator Rest on the bill? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, I'd just like to thank Senator Rest and former Senator Tingelstad for your persistence on something that I know just has so much meaning to a lot of people, and the fact that you're willing to continue to keep coming back with this because it's so important is something we should all appreciate. I just have a question for you, and that has to do with Subdivision 4. And my question is, looking at the language here, I wasn't sure what your intent was, but then looking at the flowchart, it seems as though the judge has to make kind of an up or down decision. And I'm wondering.
Senator Olson, that's subdivision 4.
Oh, I'm sorry,
Section
5. You know, I just remember having talked in the past with you and with some of the people who are impacted by this. One of the reasons that someone might want to seek this information is because of wanting health information. You know, there could be a medical emergency or something. And maybe the person who doesn't want the disclosure has some other compelling reasons that the judge is going to have to be weighing. And I just wonder whether there would be any benefit in making the judge have a little more flexibility in making that decision. So in other words, giving as much latitude as possible. So if the reason were that there was that health insurance or health information that was needed, could he disclose that health information, for example, as opposed to just having a totally up or down decision about the whole record or nothing?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I believe that the petition to obtain medical information is separate, can be separate from this, and the judge can rule only on that without having to grant the petition to disclose the birth parent's name.
Okay. Senator Lemmer.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rest, isn't that current law that someone can, let's say an intermediary, go to the birth mother seeking health records, and can't that be done without divulging the identity of the mother in current law?
Senator Rest.
Chair and Senator Lindberg, that certainly can be done, but you'll see in my other bill that it's not a requirement that it be provided. And I'm going to argue that when a search is done, that not only when a parent declines to have their name disclosed, that nevertheless updated medical information needs to be provided insofar as they can do so, rather than it being discretionary on their part.
Chair,
Senator Lemmer.
But that's not in this bill.
Yeah, when it came to health records that Senator Olson brought up as the example, one could also reach perhaps a mutual disclosure by the parent upon the request of the individual. You wouldn't necessarily have to have a judge do it, but
that's
you could
correct.
Have a counselor or someone who is a recognized intermediary, let's say a social service agent or someone like that, that
absolutely
can still, at least in under current law, be careful to protect the identity of the mother at the same time making a discreet contact to gain information.
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, Senator Lemmer, you're correct. And one of the services that the Department of Health already provides is this practice guide for post-adoption search services, in which the adoption agency, the person who is searching, can be very clear about what kinds of things are appropriate to pursue, the timelines. We also provide, of course, in here that the agencies that are providing these services, making it clear-cut that they can charge a fee for them, et cetera. So there is a very extensive guide for how to proceed there. But if the person refuses, then the adult adoptee has the opportunity to petition the court. But has the opportunity.
If this bill is fairly close to what you passed last year,
except for the
amended changes,
deceased parents,
the governor vetoed this bill, if I remember correctly, last year.
I mentioned that at the beginning of my
testimony.
Have
you gotten any new word of whether or not the governor has changed his opinion on whether he would sign this bill if it came across his desk?
Senator Rest.
We hope that with the folks that we know have been advising him that on the bill that he will change his mind. Do I know that he will? No, I don't. But there would be no opportunity for him to do so if we don't present him with the bill.
Madam Chair, the reason I bring it up is usually when one is trying to make another run on a policy direction of the state, you usually wait for someone to vacate office and some new possibility comes up that has a different philosophical view toward a bill. And so I'm a little intrigued that there hasn't been that much change in the legislature since that passage originally.
Senator Rust.
Madam Chair and Senator Lemmer, for a number of years, I opposed the primary seatbelt law and proposal. There was never any change in the proposal, but there was a change in me, and I now support it and I vote for it. And I felt like I became educated and listened carefully, perhaps more than I ever had before, the first year I voted for, to the arguments that were being said on its behalf. And I'm hoping that, and I trust that the governor, in an issue that's so important to many different people that are involved in adoption, would do the same. And we have no guarantee that he would sign it, but we are intent, if possible, of giving him the opportunity to do so.
Senator Rust, we were not notified of anybody else wanting to testify either for or against the bill. So any further discussions on the bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
I've debated this issue for many years. I haven't changed my mind on that. I think it should be part of the record that at one particular time in Minnesota history, at least at the very minimum, implied agreement was created by the state to protect the identity of certain mothers who requested it at the time that they did. This bill would change that relationship. It would be basically, in my opinion, reneging on an agreement. And I believe that promises made should be promises kept. The people of that generation, perhaps social expectations have changed, social definitions have changed. Today, as opposed to then, but if you have the opportunity through intermediaries to question, to seek out, to ask permission, to make contact, and they say no, why should we, in our ultimate wisdom, by a stroke of legislative fiat, change that implied contract? And I understand the issues of trying to find health records, but we do create an avenue to determine that. We have a lot of careful ways to do that. Matter of fact, Minnesota current law is probably a good example that's used across the country in a variety of states. And I've been told that only 6 states have passed something similar to what we have before us. So I know that there's people in the room that I've seen for many years come here, but I still remain of the mind that promises made should be promises kept, especially with the opportunities that are in law to contact these individuals.
Senator Rust.
I certainly respect Senator Lemmer's opposition, and it is and it's thoughtful, and it's well known. I believe that on this particular issue, however, that the compromises that we have made between the opportunities that already exist for birth parents to exercise either disclosure or non-disclosure, and the right and opportunity for an adopted person to know as much about themselves as anybody else knows, that compromise and balance has been accomplished in this legislation, and there is that opportunity for a birth parent to continue to say no.
Representative Tingelstad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm really honored to be here in the Senate hearing, and I want to thank Senator Rust for her dedication with this bill for so many years, and I just wish I could still be a legislator when hopefully it's passed and signed into law this year, but Representative Aaron Murphy in the House has been kind enough to carry the bill this year. Madam Chair, if I could just make a quick comment as it relates to Senator Lemmer's previous statement. I just wanted to make note that as far as protecting of the identity, we've done a lot of research. We have some materials from Rutgers from, you know, decades ago, that the reason that the information on the birth certificates was closed was actually to protect the adoptee and the adopted family, not the birth mother. And so at that time, there were situations where the adopted child was ostracized for not being a natural child, so to speak. And so somehow through the decades, that information was out there that it's to protect the birth mother, but in essence it's not. And in fact, I know we have people in the audience that will tell you personal point of views from a birth parent's point of view on what was said or not said at the time of placement. So I just want to refute that comment based on, you know, the factual evidence that we've seen through our research. Thank you.
Any further discussions? Senator Olson moves that Senate File 137 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Tingelstad. Senate File 164. Are you in on this one too, Representative Tingelstad? Well, you showed up, so you might as well stay at the table.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All the other bills.
Madam Chair, Senate File 164 occurred to me when we were discussing the other bill last year, and the very point that Senator Limmer was raising about the opportunity that adult adoptees have currently to use, having nothing to do really with their original birth certificate, but have the opportunity to do searches with the help and for a fee of the adoption agencies to help them find their birth parent and to discover if the birth parent would be willing to have contact with the adult adoptee and or provide medical information. And I asked the agencies, well, for those birth parents that you search out and have contact with, at that point, do you ask them if they say no to file the affidavit of nondisclosure so that then they are protected, period, regardless? And the answer was, well, no, not particularly. And so it seemed to me that, again, for the protection at this point, between now and when that other law would become effective, that when there is a search done, that one of the things that should happen is if the birth parent says they do not want contact, that they be required to sign an affidavit of nondisclosure and get that on the record. If they if they're unclear, they're still able to file no affidavit of disclosure or an affidavit of disclosure. But if they're certain that they do not want contact, then they would be required to get that on the record, and then the information would be clear to all the parties. At the same time, it seemed to me that even if there were an affidavit of nondisclosure filed at that time and the birth parent has like 30 days to do so after the contact, and generally that period of contact, if you looked at that timeline thing, that's still out there is sometimes it takes 6 months, sometimes it takes a year to find someone, so it's a long time. And sometimes they can be told that the birth parent can say, no, I don't think I want that, and so forth. And there's a timeline, but it has a lot of flexibility in it, is what I'm trying to say. So that then they would have the opportunity to think about it and then sign an affidavit of nondisclosure when they made that decision. And then in addition, that providing medical information no longer be or certainly be clear that it's not optional. And what impressed me about requiring that is a, I believe it's a recent profile and booklet publication from the American Medical Association that talks about how important family medical history is in disease prevention. And for the AMA has forms for people to fill out about their family history, both for adults and also for prenatal screening questionnaires. And it seems to me that that kind, for an adult adoptee, this information should be filled in. It shouldn't be blank because they are they were adopted. And so we, in the bill, we ask that the at that time, that within 30 days again, a full month, that the birth parent provide updated medical history insofar as they're able to do so. So there's just the two provisions there.
Any questions for Senator Rest? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rest, if 30 days goes by and they don't get a response from the parent, can you tell me what happens?
Senator Rest?
Well, Senator Limmer, they would be breaking the law because there's a requirement to file the affidavit of nondisclosure.
So the
rather than just saying no.
So, Madam Chair, the affidavit of nondisclosure would stand?
Yes, indeed.
If there was no response after 30 days?
Oh, yes.
But, Madam Chair,
it's binding, Senator Limmer.
Does that then, how does that, does it conflict with the earlier bill that we just passed?
No.
How would it not conflict?
Senator Rest?
Confused.
The earlier bill is effective August 1st of 2010. I see this bill as in a transition phase, that the searches that are going on right now, the before the other bill would take effect, if this bill passed, the affidavit of nondisclosure with a search when someone says no would have to be filed now. So it would already be on the books. With the other bill, it would have to be done. It would have to be done by August 1st of 2010. We're just giving them in this bill lead time to do what they would otherwise be required to do by August 1st of 2010, and also to provide the updated medical history. I've thought about whether they contradicted one another, and I don't think they do.
Any further questions for Senator Rest? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe this is just a little bit off topic. I'm just wondering, when someone is adopted, the medical records from their birth, whether they had identifying information or not, including, I think, their APGAR score and that type of thing. Is that something that is given? I mean, does the adopted person automatically have access to those records, or would those be considered the birth mother's records? And if not, shouldn't we send those records along with the person who's being adopted just as a part of the process?
Why don't you come on up to the table?
I need somebody to walk us through that one about whether the medical records, certainly for the baby, would be given to the adopted family.
Okay.
And what we are dealing with here in both instances, in both bills, is an adopted adult's access to medical information.
Right. Welcome to the committee.
Hi
please
there.
State your name for the record.
My name is Carrie Blaisner.
Can you
and
is
I,
it BLA?
BLESENER.
Thank you.
I can speak probably to both of these. I'm an adopted adult. I searched through my agency. My birth mother said no. I then asked my agency, I want all medical information I rightfully have the right to have sent to me, and you can, you know, redact what you need to redact. I did receive some information from my birth because I was born not breathing with a bad APGAR score, so they ended up transferring me to Children's Hospital. So I did get some records. However, they were very difficult to read. They were sketchy, and I think that it would be different for every adoptee. There may be some adoptees who would have no medical record because they didn't have problems. I did ask, my agency did ask my birth mother to update the medical records, and she refused. So consequently, I have no medical records because there was nothing requiring her to do that. They asked, and she said no. So I have, scant medical information. When I go to the doctor, I have to put a big fat X through everything.
They're blank.
They're blank. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, coming up to middle age. It would be, I do think that that, now there are things that are, I know, but I am. But it's getting difficult in that the doctors now are asking me about my history and my tests, and do we need to do this, and do we need to do that? And I can't give them an answer because I don't know. So it's cost me more money to decide, do I want to do this test or that test to determine whether or not I'm at risk. So that, in terms of the medical records, it's not required, and I think it would be a case-by-case basis as to whether or not you would have medical records on file with your agency, whether they have them or not.
Thank you for the information. Any further discussions on Senate File 164?
Oh, Madam Chair, I did have an author's amendment to this bill, too. And at the end of the bill, on page 2, lines 213 through lines 216, the author's amendment is to reinstate the stricken language. Simply because there would be a requirement if the birth parent said no to file the affidavit of nondisclosure. I still believe that the agency should inform them of the right to file the affidavit of disclosure. And at this point, because that other proposal hasn't passed, to also inform the birth parent of the effect of the failure of the parent to file them. The consent or the non-consent. So I would appreciate those lines, the stricken lines, being reinstated.
Senator Scheid moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment to put the bill into the shape the author would like it to be in. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Limmer?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, in this particular bill, this is just narrowly focused on medical data. Would identifying elements to the mother be?
Madam Chair,
and Senator Rest,
if the mother refused to consent to disclosing her name, there would only be one requirement that she would have, and it would not include disclosing her name. And as you, as Ms. Blaisner indicated, information that came to her had been redacted. Any information that would have identified a birth parent was blacked out. And I would assume that included not only name, but address and so forth. But the medical information itself would be required to be reported, or someone could, have a right to call them on it, sue them. I guess they could do that anyway, but this would at least let the birth parent know that there is no choice, and if they were taken to court, that they would have to provide it because the law says they do. The non-identifying medical history.
Senator Lamar.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, did your witness, did she get her medical data?
She got medical data from when she was born because
Ms. Blaisner, come back up to the microphone because we have to have you on the record.
As far as I know, because from what she said, because she was born with in distress. But when she did a search for updated medical history, the birth parent said no. And under this bill, the birth parent would not be allowed to say no. She'd have to provide it.
Madam Chair?
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I'd
like to move that Senate File 164 as amended be recommended to pass.
And be referred to the floor.
Goes to the floor.
Any further discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Is it my turn now?
It's your turn,
yes.
Senator Higgins.
Yes.
Thank you, ladies, for coming in. Represent Tingelstad and Senator Scheid and the women in the audience.
Senator Bradford.
Who've been sitting here. Thank you very much. And one guy, they said.
Madam Chair, I think you just called Senator West Senator Scheid.
Oh, sorry, Senator West.
She doesn't even know that you did that.
We deeply apologize for that.
Yeah, I'm going to try to avoid that. Yeah.
Hi, Senator Higgins, Senate File 350. Oh, bless you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a housekeeping bill from the Post Board, and it updates and clarifies the Post Board's duties and procedures regarding pre-service and continuing education requirements for peace officers. There are no substantive changes in either the Post Board's powers or duties. And Madam Chair, it looks to me like some good editor took a whack at this provision of law and did some lovely things like changing monies to money, and the phrase universities, colleges, and technical colleges became post-secondary schools, and other good cleanup editing work. And I have Mr. Melton here from the Post Board. He's the executive director, and he can answer any questions and tell you anything more that that I didn't, because I hardly told you anything.
Mr. Melton, welcome to the committee. Do you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Neil Melton. I am the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training, and this is our housekeeping bill, and it's 30 years overdue, sort of. What we're trying to do is bring the current statutory language in line with the language from the administrative rules as well as practices, and as Senator Higgins said, we're using leading practice languages now, so that everyone understands what it is we're talking about with the colleges, the universities, and the training providers.
Well, Mr. Melton, you chose the right author for the bill. Any questions for Senator Higgins or Mr. Melton?
Roll call.
Seeing none, Senator Higgins moves.
That Senate File 350 be recommended to pass. Madam Chair, would this be appropriate for the consent calendar?
I think the will of the committee may prevail on that. Let's. Any objections?
I just have a question.
Oh, Senator Scheid.
And I'm sure it probably could go there. I'm just curious because I'm trying to catch up with it. And I just, it's a detail, but I noticed that you cross out, you delete full-time, wherever it says peace officers, but you leave part-time. Are they defined someplace else, or wouldn't peace officers just be peace officers, or does it have to be differentiated that there are peace officers and there are part-time peace officers?
Mr. Melton.
Madam Chair and Senator, yes, they are defined differently in statute. They are two specific different licenses.
Okay, good. Any further discussions? Senator Higgins renews her motion to re-refer Senate File 350 to the consent calendar. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
See, Madam Chair, you really do better if you don't say this is an easy bill when you sit down.
Members, I believe that's the bulk of our work for the day. We have one bill on Thursday. It will be a short day. So for scheduling purposes, we should look to be getting out of here around 4, at 4:30. Yes.
I'll have a lot of questions.
The committee is adjourned.